Thank you very much, Ian and David and Ivan and John, for another EPO, a little later in the year, so we had a bit of a time to absorb some of the year, and it has been well timed. The title is not indicative of the weather, although for our two interstate visitors, Chris from Sydney and Jonathan from Adelaide, particularly Jonathan, we wanted to show him what rain does look like for the last few weeks. But it is important to state the obvious. I've left out the word bleeding there, that we do have a new government. When Ian referred to that event, I thought he was going to talk about the event last year rather than the event last week, which elected a new government. But it's perhaps not that obvious to many of us because, it's been the most seamless transition from the old government to the new government that I've seen. I've said since the war, but I can go back to... I can't go back quite that far, but I certainly can go back to 1972 with the election of the new... of the Whitlam government. This is the first time I've seen such a smooth transition from literally Peter and John walk out the door on Friday, Kevin, Swain and Julia, etc., walked in the door on Monday, and life went on pretty much as before. Now, you might find that's... I guess it's important to remember that this is not... It's the first time we've had a new government, obviously, in 12 years, and the world in 1996, when we last had a change of government, was very, very different to the one that we live in today. I've described it as a post-Keating, pre-China world. By that I mean really that whole period had been dominated by first Keating's economic agenda, economic reform agenda, and then Keating as Prime Minister. And it really, we didn't realise that China was about to burst into our lives quite the way it did. And it's certainly not a return to a 1996 future. Only two of the big four, and by the big four I mean the four key members of this new government, Kevin, Lindsay Tanner, Julie Gillard and Wayne Swan, only two of the big four were there in 1996. And perhaps, I won't do it, but it would be an interesting challenge for you to nominate which of the two were there in 1996. Actually, it was Wayne Swan and Lindsay Tanner. Julia and Kevin only came into Parliament in 1998. Wayne Swan lost his seat in 1996 and came back in 1998. So this is not a government where you have people that are wanting to pick up where they left off the last time they were in power, which was certainly the case with the 1970, with some members of the 1972 incoming Whitlam government who had actually been there in 1949 and actually wanted to pick up where they'd left off in 1949. And I guess in those days you could almost do it because the world in 23 years didn't change all that much. It certainly changed dramatically in the last 10. So it's not even a return to a 1983 future because, of course, climate change is harder to cure than a drought. We all remember Bob Hawke came in and immediately cured the drought back then. Now, I should start by admitting, again, the chairman was generous in not saying that perhaps I should have made an apology for being wrong last year. I didn't specifically say that John Howard was going to win a re-election, but I certainly would have left you with that impression, if you can remember back that far, that it was going to be extremely difficult for Kevin Rudd to win. As we discovered, Tintin did turn out to be Super Kev. And fortunately, he's out of the country. Otherwise, he might swoop in here and interrupt our proceedings. So why? Why did this happen? Very simply, John Howard could have survived a 4% swing. Unfortunately, the swing was 5.4%. And he didn't take the left field option, which, again, I suggested last year might have been the one thing that could change in politics as 2007 unfolded, which was to retire before the election. In fact, he got whacked by it, and that was Hurricane Maxine. And as it turned out, was quite a fortunate end to the... It might have been embarrassing, but it was certainly the best way for him to go, not having to sit there for a certain period and then resign and spark a by-election. It was quite an extraordinary result, certainly the most extraordinary result we've seen. In previous discussions, I've indicated how John Howard changed the rules of politics in this country, winning elections which he should not have won, and then he ended up losing an election he should not have lost. I don't know whether you can see that those numbers quite clearly, the red ones, but the swing that ousted Howard was 5.4% on a two-party basis, which, apart from 1975, is the largest swing against an incumbent government where they lose since the war, which is quite extraordinary when you think about the context in which this happened. If you look at 1975, the reality was, you're surprised perhaps that the swing wasn't more like 20%. you would have had to be almost clinically certifiable not to have voted against the Whitlam government in those circumstances in 1975. So it's quite extraordinary that you had this very big swing, particularly when we measure it against the misery index. It's something that's tended to go out of fashion in recent times, probably because we now seem to be in this era of secularly low inflation. But the misery index, the traditional measure of the misery index, is the unemployment rate plus the inflation rate. And you can see that he lost. Those numbers haven't quite matched up. But you can see back in 1975, when Whitlam lost, the misery index was nearly 17%. This time around it was only 6%, the inflation rate plus the jobless rate. I've added another line, which is the leverage, what I call the leveraged misery index, where you add the housing mortgage rate. And even on that basis, you can see that there was no real reason to eject this government in those conventional contexts. So I would describe it as a super extraordinary outcome. Now, so that's the first contradiction I want to spend a little time on today, that the electorate wanted to get rid of John Howard, but only if they could replace him with John Howard. And that was really the dynamic that unfolded through 2007, both in a personal sense and in a policy sense. Kevin really projected himself as the younger version, the younger clone of John Howard. And they certainly didn't want to replace him with Peter Costello, but they wanted another John Howard. The answer, I think, is they wanted to get rid of Howard the man, but not Howard the policy. And essentially that's something that is certainly driven in the new government's approach to policy so far. Just a reality check, though, in the sort of presumption that everybody wanted a change of government, 47% still voted for the previous government. That's nearly 6 million voters. And if 185,000 across the board had not switched votes, we still would have Prime Minister John Howard in Kirribilli House. I haven't gone to that ridiculous extent of looking at the 10 most marginal electorates and saying if only 6,500 people or 16,500 people hadn't voted the other way, he would have been re-elected. That's on a two-party basis. Contradiction number two, I have said it's the most seamless transition since the war, but we've also had this radical symbolism. Kyoto, the apology, and perhaps something not quite so symbolic, work choices. So there's a contradiction there. Now, the seamlessness, I think, is driven by two things. The underlying economic reality, that we've had this new government come into power and say, my goodness gracious me, we've discovered with great shock and horror that the economy is booming. We've discovered this, we've gone down into the bowels of Treasury and discovered this more of a budget white mountain than a budget black hole. Every previous change of government, there's been a context of some crisis in the economy and a crisis in the budget. Back in 1986, back in 1983. And this hasn't been the case today. But it's also something, it also speaks to something more specific and more dynamic about Kevin Rudd, which I'll come to. And just to digress briefly, though, even the Cabinet is a little puzzled by the people that I speak to. Even the Cabinet's a little bit puzzled about Kevin. They'd like to see him actually remove that super Kev outfit and discover what the real Kevin underneath really looks like. And I think that this contradiction is captured in the summit, which is something that is very not John Howard, as you will appreciate, and the budget, which is very much a continuation of the Howard-Costello dynamic. So understanding both Kevins and the way this government will approach the next 3 years, the next 6 years, and probably the next 9 years, is this combination of soft new age corporatism, where everybody is to come into the tent, not just in the old style, and certainly not in the early years of the Hawke-Keating government, governments, unions, and try and get business in there as well. And you bring into this tent especially fuzzy thinkers that can, in both senses of the word, the positive sense and the negative sense, to sort of bounce big issues around without much real policy substance or policy direction. And on the other hand, there's the Howard Costello fiscal traditionalism, which is essentially surpluses and tax cuts. The contradiction is explained by understanding that this reveals the mind and processes of somebody who's essentially a bureaucrat. He's not an ideologue. He's not somebody that has a clear policy dynamic which is driving him, or an ideology that's driving him. Kevin's formulation and his formation as a political leader is one that is driven by his experiences as a bureaucrat and his mindset in the Queensland government in the early 1990s. So to think about how this government is going to progress, you have to hold those two slightly contradictory thoughts. The summit is real. It may not lead to any real positive outcomes. It's sort of a bigger version of these community cabinets that he's been imposing. Apparently, all the cabinet is required to go to the summit, but they're not to say anything. They're not to contribute to it. They're there to listen, which is going to be an interesting exercise. And it's about fuzzy vision and about fuzzy direction, because Kevin doesn't have a plan, despite his comments and what he was saying through the course of 07. But so also is the budget. The budget is a very real reality, and it's going to unfold over the next 6 weeks. And it's the practical delivery, if you like, of the sort of bureaucratic dynamic that Kevin is projecting. Why is the budget unfolding the way it is, built around this determination to achieve what are, at the end of the day, really quite minor budget cuts, while also keeping the tax cuts in place? There's the conventional political imperative. You slash into 12 years of waste that has built up, even with the best of governments, and I think we all appreciate that the last government was not the best of governments, and you seek to head off new waste. You either cut now or you forever hold your cuts, in very simple terms. And the policy imperative is twofold. It's about putting in place a formulation for the budget which enables you to focus on the things you actually want to do with budget policy going forward, and very narrowly, that fiscal versus monetary debate. Do we have a high surplus? Does that bias lower interest rates, or vice versa? Now, I'm particularly vexed by this, and I was talking to Jonathan about it before. He might have something to say. Chris might have something to say about the pointlessness of this argument about we should abolish the tax cuts in order to take pressure off interest rates. Cutting the cuts is essentially pointless in a fiscal policy sense. It's going to be either what exactly we need if, in fact, the economy turns down over the course of 08-09, and Chris will have more to say about that, obviously. It's also pointless in a chronological sense, given that rates have already risen. You can't trade off a rate rise yesterday against a tax cut tomorrow. You might be able to trade off a tax cut tomorrow against a future rate rise, but I challenge anybody in this room to tell me and to guarantee what's going to happen to interest rates over the course of 08 and 09. It's also mathematically challenged, people that say that we should abandon the tax cuts. Let me just take you through those numbers at the bottom of the page. It's the journey of the 2006 budget surplus. In the 2006 budget in May 06, it was projected to be $10 billion. By the mid-year economic update, it was $12.6 billion. By the 2007 budget, when you have most of the year in, it was projected at $16 billion. And it finished the year at $19 billion when it actually came in. Now, that's not the actual number, because that's before the new policy initiatives that were taken at various stages of the year, including some spending and including some further cutting tax cuts. But it was mostly on the spending side. But it was the underlying change in the budget. And the tax cuts in 2008-09 are going to be $6.6 billion. So in terms of what's happened in previous budgets, they will be absorbed and exceeded by the increase in the net bottom line, principally a consequence of revenue, if the previous budget process is delivered, which, of course, the economic environment is probably unlikely to do that. The outcome, narrowly, from the budget is that they will deliver the budget cuts. They will deliver the tax cuts. They are, in fact, locked in now by legislation. And, as I've indicated, the budget outcome will be overtaken by events in any event. Let me talk a little bit about the people, the key people in this government. There are four, and I've put them in order of importance. Kevin, obviously, I think we all have a sort of a broad understanding of Kevin. I've tried to fill that out by giving you a sense that he has really the mindset and the processes of a bureaucrat. All of them, I think, have now been mugged by one overwhelming reality. They want to win the next election. They want to stay where they are. I saw Julie Gillard at Kirribilli House yesterday. She seemed to be settling in very nicely to the role of Prime Minister in residence, so to speak. The second most important person in the budget is Lindsay Tanner. in the government, sorry, is Lindsay Tanner, the finance minister. That's a function of his own value and his own skills. It's also a function of the relative weakness of the treasurer. It's a very, obviously a very different dynamic to the previous government with Peter Costello and Nick Minchin in those two roles. Lindsay is the man that's the intellectual heart of this government in terms of the practical policy dynamic and the practical policy realisation. Julia is narrowly very important in terms of work choices, but she clearly wants to be the next Prime Minister, and preferably sooner rather than later, which is not to suggest that there's going to be any leadership tension in the party in the near term, but certainly her focus is very much on effectively delivering on the industrial relations portfolio, but also in furthering her narrow personal ambition to succeed Kevin. And there was a lot of trading that went on in the course of 07 in terms of why they've ended up in those roles, that Julia chose not to be Treasurer for two reasons, basically. One is that her skill base, her focus has been industrial relations, but also as part of that process of managing the factions that no longer exist and allowing Wayne Swan to, from the right, to fill that role. And Wayne Swan, I think, again, will be there for the foreseeable future. He's not going to disappear anytime soon, but he is the weakest member of the top four. And then there's everyone else. They all have their roles in their specific portfolio. So the changes that are going to occur from the new government. One is the budget. Not really a change, it's a continuation of the previous regime. Interest rates are in the hands of the gods, and by that I mean not only Glenn Stevens, but obviously the gods of Wall Street, the masters of the universe. Work choices is the single most important short-term change, the abolition thereof, under this government, and the one that will really drive the dynamic in a practical outcome sense over the course of this first term. We will have carbon trading, that's fairly clear now, not a carbon tax, and we will have it. We were going to get it from the previous government as well. And then there's everything else. Now, Jonathan's going to talk about federalism, but I think we saw a demonstration yesterday that new federalism is pretty much the old federalism plus money. In the case of the water deal yesterday, Victoria finally bowed because of the common sense that was articulated by Kevin before he left the country, and the $1 billion that he happened to throw on the table. And we saw $1 billion extra going into health. A preliminary primer to finish with, the big four will evolve into the big three over time, but it's not going to happen in the short run. There'll be big ideas demonstrated by the summit, but most of the action on the ground which will affect you directly will be small, and it will be essentially process driven. It'll be functional rather than ideological or big policy in terms of actual outcomes, with those exceptions of work choices, which is now the abolition thereof, and how carbon trading develops at the end of the year. Governments always evolve into governments. That's another reality that we should never forget, that whatever they might start out thinking they're going to do, they end up running the place on a day-to-day basis and reacting to events. And the opposition is irrelevant, especially after June 30 when the Senate changes. And the one big prediction I will make, that Malcolm will rise before next Easter and the next time we come together. Thank you very much.